I have a slight tweak to the title of my paper that I would like to adjust for the record, since it's not in the thing, in the little program, and it is the Sociopolitical Spiderweb and the Corporate Adventist Identity, a View from Inside and Outside in the 21st Century. I have to briefly introduce the reason for the change and what I'm trying to draw out with this analogy of the spider and the spider web. And it's very simple. No matter what kind of nice spider web the little insect may be admiring when it flies around enjoying its trip through nature, when it vibrates that little web, the spider, what does the spider do? It becomes aware that there is something there, that something has entered its world, and the spider runs right along the web and grabs the little bug that made the unfortunate mistake of visiting that part of the woods or near that log or that tree or that branch. So spiders, they wait for you. They wait for you, the little bugs, and when you enter their world, they win. That's generally what happens. So that's what we're talking about on the sociopolitical spider web and the corporate Adventist identity, a view from a little bit inside and outside. My study actually involved multiple parts that I cannot share all of them here. I actually was trying to talk about first what corporateness really means and is and why it's important for the church in part one. And then in part two, I focused on one component of the socio-eschatological picture, kind of an idea that I thought would help explain why we as Adventists are struggling perhaps a little bit to understand and relate to the world, particularly in America. I want to add that this is an American-centric, Amerocentric perspective, and that around the world things are very different in different ways, although I think that perhaps with America's prominence in Adventist eschatology and theology, there are lessons that can be learned at a philosophical level that are interesting for anyone. But the thing that I focused on was the cup of iniquity. I'm only going to summarize very briefly, apologies, summarize very briefly what I concluded and why it might help confuse us in today's world. I believe that the cup of iniquity, primarily through the spirit of prophecy, through Ellen White's writings, functions in kind of a unique way for the end times. If you look back through her usage of the concept throughout Old Testament history, you know, throughout all of the entire Old Testament history with the various nations that Israel faced, to fill one's cup of iniquity as an individual, but primarily as a nation, involved indulging in a variety of sins. Although one sin may tip the scales or cause the overflow, nevertheless, there is much more emphasis on the aggregate weight of many sins, including both natural and moral, so that the last sin could be any sin. This is also how it works in our individual lives, is it not? No specific sin is singled out as necessary for us to fill our cup to the point of being having it necessary for God to give divine judgment on us. So there's no specific sin that is really singled out. Anything can happen to the individual. However, in the traditional Adventist eschatological picture, things are different. It's no amount of sins that will cause the overflow. It is rather one specific sin that will fill America's and the world's cup of iniquity, and that is, interestingly, a proactive counter of the moral law, the Sunday versus Sabbath. Not keeping the Sabbath won't cause the overflow. It is rather forcing a false Sabbath. This is kind of unique in the concept of cup of iniquity throughout her writings and how it's used. She applies it to the Old Testament. What makes this interesting for the socio-political identity problem in relationship to religious identities is that false Christians may correctly recognize any or all other grosser or natural evils and moral evils and even make steps to correct or alleviate them that we might be in sympathy with. This tempts Adventists, I believe, to play a game of socio-political identity partnerships, a game like the little bug with the spider web we will always lose. I hope to discuss here the context of this in the 21st century United States, American context, and share what I think might be a better response. So, a brief introduction to my interest in this. I have to share that as a multi-generational Seventh-day Adventist, I'm related via marriage to William Miller. I'm a multi-generational American. I had ancestors on the Mayflower. I actually started my studies alongside religion. I also got a bachelor's degree in history. So, and I at Andrews University. So I'm an Adventist of the Adventists. I'm an American of the Americans, and that's kind of. And I've studied history, so I really appreciate and have a passion about this. Nevertheless, I've come to realize, with all of that combination background, that American Adventism, to say nothing of the rest of the world, is presently tangled within the web of a very widespread socio-political or worldview identity spiderweb trap that is paradigmatically centered in the United States. Of course, this is not to ignore our various theological challenges. However, I believe our socio-political worldview tensions and theological tensions are related, although I will not pursue them very deeply here. That is its own web to perhaps untangle another time and is indeed a complex web. Here I will only detail a few of the ways socio-political identities are sticking to Christians and Adventists. So I will also be talking about, remember, the outside, so other Christians as well as the Adventists. What stands out about this worldview identity trap is that while many American religious denominations, primarily Christian groups I'm interested in, are struggling with the spiderweb trap phenomena, in addition to the dropping attendance of their members in today's religiously apathetic atmosphere, other church denominations are not responding to the worldview identity trap in the same way we are, for two primary reasons. First, they either had a stronger socio-political identity to start with, forcing challengers to that identity to abandon their parental religion altogether and or find another choice. Or second, the chances are high that such a church has already literally split or fragmented owing to the socio-political pressures, creating new identity options for the remaining adherents to choose from and thus remain within one of the major factions of their group. This means that although there are broad ecumenical movements afoot, as Adventists are often keen to point out because of our interest in an anticipated Sunday law, universal ecumenism is not universal. Religious groups, including Christians, are also still continuing to fragment because of deeply rooted differences. As I will point out below, this fragmentation is, in America, to some extent polarizing into two opposing socio-political ideological extremes that do possess philosophically interesting attributes. Thus, some, there are notable exceptions, of the ecumenism that is seen is the drawing together of various religious groups into these two opposing extremes. That said, learning from and more fully understanding the challenges of these corporate worldview identities from both sociopolitical, theological, philosophical perspectives, etc., as they interrelate with theology and religious groups, should hold considerable value for us as Adventists as we try and engage the world in the 21st century. And it will help us, I hope, understand the price we pay for being identified with other groups, other identities, identifying with them as ourselves, or being identified with them by others. Get that, the inside versus the outside. So when we choose to identify, or when others identify us with them against our will. As I said, sometimes you don't get to choose your nickname, do you? Sometimes when you grow up, you're just given a nickname, and it sticks for whatever reason. I like to play baseball, and when I beat out a ground ball to shortstop running to first, they called me Wheels, and it stuck for the whole season. Every time whether or not I made it safe or not, Wheels, Wheels, so I could run down the line fast. So we don't always choose our nicknames. Sometimes they're given to us, and we don't have a choice. Okay. Section 1 here, the contemporary divisions and their implications in America. From roughly the end of World War I, around 1916 presidential election, to 1980, political fluidity reigned in America. There was a lot of major shifts and demographic shuffling and different people. Obviously there are trends and patterns. American historians could go back and look at this, but there was a lot more fluidity. My own parents, when they were married, came from opposite political sympathies. They have now both left those political sympathies and become independent. But I just have to share that there was a lot more fluidity. It was no big deal as it sometimes seems to be today. However, I'm going to detail three interesting facts about the socio-political identities and the relevance for Christianity and Adventism. Begin with interesting fact number one. Coinciding with the recognition of the rise of the American culture war around 1991 with sociologist James Davison Hunter's classic book Culture Wars, The Struggle to Define America and Its Later Use by Patrick Buchanan, in a speech at the Republican National Convention in 1992 explicitly uniting religion and politics, political polarization in the U.S. House of Representatives, Senate, and White House is currently cresting in 2014 at the highest level since shortly after the end of the South's Reconstruction in 1877 following our American Civil War. This is seen clearly with more votes on significant bills in Congress aligning almost strictly alongside a politician's party affiliation, presently Republicans and Democrats, than ever before in history on both domestic and foreign policy issues. Perhaps the most expensive and important domestic bill in history, the American Affordable Care Act, well illustrates this division. Although genuine moderates or issue-based independents, notably frustration with the polarization has led some to declare as independents who are actually representatives of even more extreme positions, are still alive and breathing amongst the more indifferent or ignorant general population, although I note that young adults who fancy themselves independent very often lean to the left, that studies have shown this. Self-identifying conservatives and liberals, these words that need to be banished from Adventism, and something needs to happen there, but self-identifying conservatives and liberals are at an all-time high, and this is reflected clearly within those who do identify with one of the two major parties, Republicans or Democrats. There are now fewer liberal Republicans or conservative Democrats than ever before, even as the number of independents has also reached historic highs for some of the complex reasons I mentioned above, like extremism. This means, however, that there are 58% of the country that are true partisans. Furthermore, if you happen to follow the world news regularly, especially obsessively, through the media, studies have shown that the chances are higher you also have a more polarized view of the socio-political picture in America. In other words, the more informed you are through the news sources you trust most, the more one-sided your socio-political perspectives usually become. Additionally, the mass popularity of so-called extreme groups are seen readily with the names like Occupy Wall Street, the Tea Party, etc., which have secularized the older, strictly moral religious side of the culture war with a focus on various humanitarian and economic issues. Importantly, this mustn't be forgotten. The broad contours of this culture war are not going away anytime soon. This is because a large-scale historic migration is underway from rural areas to urban centers and so forth, and new megacities, meaning the culture war will continue in to grow in ever-deepening ways. As Laura Meckler and Dante Shini concur with David Wasserman, sometimes politics hangs on culture and lifestyle more than policy, and most rural or countryside people vote Republican while the growing cities vote Democrat. In any case, as county-level voting maps for the past few presidential elections indicates, especially since 1992, where in more populated zones, you've heard of the blue cities, are increasingly at odds with the more geographically large, spread out, and less populated red heartland areas, rural areas, political polarization is very real among both the general populace and the politicians who naturally must cater to their constituents who elected them. It is quite remarkable to see a, like for example, 2008 or 12 U.S. county level political map, not just the state level electoral college, but the county level map that is geographically 85% red, and yet to realize the blue team actually won the presidency fairly easily. This means we're quite polarized. This kind of enduring polarization has never occurred in our country's history in quite this way before. We're now going on 25 years of development, even as it goes back and forth between different parties. This deeply rooted polarization is growing, actually. Okay, interesting fact number two, religion and politics. While there is surely socio-political identity mobility amongst the members of most major religious groups, the trend since 1980 has been to combine religious identities with a single socio-political identity to gain greater influence and power. The greater polarization of Americans' political realities require this. It's natural. Combined with the religious identity's convictions and emphasis on any number of moral or social issues. For example, the rise of the previously mentioned religious right, also identified with the labels like the Moral Majority and Christian Coalition in the 1980s and 90s, matches this profile and has been pointed out and strongly emphasized by several prominent conservative, centrist, and more liberal or progressive Adventists over the last 25 years, including in ATS. In brief, the religious right represents a coalition of several conservative or traditional Christian groups and denominations that share enough of a world view to combine into a single socio-political identity. That worldview, in quick Christianized language, could be described as the capitalistic moral gospel perspective. And there are many books that explicitly unite this together. I won't be sharing my footnotes, but what matters most is the individual's morality is to be guided legislatively to varying degrees, while the individual is to be on their own to increase their wealth, health, and happiness, which is surely holy wealth if they are moral in following the guidelines. Obedience to the moral Ten Commandments, side of the law, biblical marriage, you hear about gay marriage, biblical marriage, and all these kinds of issues, homosexual, issues, is important, and that's what's paramount, etc., and I will skip a few lines. Many of them are quite moderate. However, as is well known amongst Adventist circles, some members of the religious right also pursue their agenda through a post-millennial kingdom on earth eschatological lens, which is very alarming to us. However, again, they are not all united on one single view of the millennium, and you will find a lot of variance, including amongst Protestants, Catholics, etc. So there is a lot of variance, although that one particular idea of the post-millennial religious right Christian is the scariest, because that means they need to perfect reality before the millennium can begin and before Jesus could come after the millennium. If a year were given for the official birth date of the religious right, it would be 1980, when Ronald Reagan ran for president and the Republican Party adopted some of the concerns of the Christian right, like repealing Roe versus Wade, the abortion bill of 1973, expressed by individuals like the Jerry Falwell, who founded the Moral Majority. However, it must be noted that although the conservative impulses of more fundamentalist-leaning or traditional Protestant Christians had intersected with politics in their modern form earlier in the century, this is to explain what's going on, but prior to 1980, even theologically conservative Catholics were mostly Democrats, as illustrated by presidential candidates like Al Smith and John F. Kennedy in 1928 and 1960. So the modern picture that I've been building you and sharing here is that it really can't begin until 1980 and beyond, the real culture wars. That's when they chose a single socio-political rallying flag and a presidential candidate, a somewhat unwilling Ronald Reagan. On the flip side, however, and many Adventists I've discovered are not very aware about this as I've dialogued with them, there is now a very vibrant religious left. As Stephen Schifrin observes, although the mass media tend to ignore it, there is a strong religious left in the United States. End quote. As such, although the religious left is a more complex movement and less organized in some ways than the right has historically been, and is thus often unwisely ignored, I would suggest alongside Daniel Flynn that it actually has much deeper historical roots than the right that directly shaped the contemporary political polarization in America. In contrast to the moral gospel of the right, the left's gospel can be encapsulated in the softer moral influence theories, and particularly the social or prosperity gospel. It is primarily concerned with decreasing poverty, improving equality of various sorts, and resolving any number of social ills and illnesses. Leftist Christianity, understood primarily as corporate social transformation, Christianized socialism, alongside these more theoretically concrete public goals, has existed actually since the earliest European settlement of America with the Pilgrims. They started out as communists, and it nearly destroyed them, as Daniel Flynn notes. It is important to note that in some senses the religious left and right were at times the same groups and people prior to 1980. This is again a key point to understand. And the modern development of our socio-political divisions when the culture wars began. Totalitarian thinking represents the extremes of both the stereotypical left and right, who in many ways think the same way, they just apply their way of thinking towards slightly different goals, like social transformation versus moral transformation. They basically just, you know, shuffle what their focus is. The same occurs, by the way, I believe, in Adventism, with the ultra-progressives or liberals and the extreme fundamentalists. I would suggest that philosophically they actually think very similarly. They just apply their reasoning and their minds to different objectives, but they think the same way. This is actually why I believe many today are sometimes confused and have mistaken previous generations of Christian activists as precursors to religious right or whatever it may be. However, as Mark Edwards in a recent book correctly observes, evidence shows that the evangelical left and right cannot be segmented so easily. Historically, both religious parties have sought to save their souls by gaining the whole world. In its contemporary development, however, the telltale sign of the religious left is its abandonment of and a special focus on the moral part of the law to focus on a variety of social transformation issues. I will skip a few lines. Social justice is their key phrase. And the moral dimension of the law is often reinterpreted, like, for example, support for homosexual marriage and pro-choice on abortion. These are like the two hot-button traditional issues for the culture wars. Lastly, I do want to mention that although the secular left has risen to prominence during recent decades, especially since 1950s after World War II, in many ways the secular left's agenda is actually just a repackaging of the religious left's original agenda. There is great harmony between the secular left and the religious left. However, on the right side, the alliances between the secular right and the religious right are a little bit looser and not quite so tight. The significance of the religious left and the religious right in America is simple in their relationship to their socio-political identities, as you've probably gathered. Few other countries have such a simplistic reduction. Many other countries have multi-party systems or parliamentarian systems. You know, governments, you know, they're just organized differently, and so they don't have this simplicity, which is, again, philosophically interesting. So we, America provides, I think, a unique analogies and illustrations to study. Basically, again, the left and the right have come to align with the Democrat and Republican parties, respectively, in 2014. After more than a century of development in religious political philosophy, America has indeed simplified things down into these two major positions or stances. Of course, reality is always more complex than meets the eye, and we don't want to become overly simplistic in how we treat this, but these general contours do hold to be fairly true. The point I want to make is that most major denominations and religious groups do have a single socio-political identity. That is a key point. I want to give a couple of examples. For example, if you're a student of American religion, you'll know that Mormons and Southern Baptist evangelicals are overwhelmingly Republican and conservative in their socio-political leanings. Conversely, Protestant churches, mainline traditional Protestant churches, lean Democrat, as do many historic black Pentecostal and charismatic churches, which in that case are often socio-religiously conservative. But many other religious groups also, I just wanted to touch on other groups that fall into these socio-political spiderwebs, also lean strongly one way or the other. For example, Muslims, Buddhists, Hindus, and Jews are also very strongly leaned to the Democrat side. And when I give an indication that they lean one way or the other, I will be saying that according to the statistics that exist from polls like Gallup and other, you know, major polling companies, they reach close to what would be called a supermajority, two-thirds, you know, at least two-thirds. Of course, there's always fluidity. Human beings are complex creatures. But when they reach a two-thirds majority, that means you have something of significance, I think. And in some cases, like Mormons, it's nearly 85%, you know. So they're all Republicans. They all think the same. They have one socio-political worldview. They have a package, okay? Noteworthy, however, besides all these minor religions, which have a disproportionate influence probably today because of our special interests-oriented political culture, is one other new movement, and you probably have thought evangelicals are mostly Republican. That was true, especially in the 1980s and 90s. However, with the rise of the emergent or emerging church, evangelicalism has also begun to fracture because emerging Christians are roughly 80% Democrats. It's just what has happened. They've realized they need a socio-political worldview, and so they've chosen the opposite of the religious right. So they are part of the religious left. And by the way, ATS authors have also written about this and have isolated both of these movements in our past JATS, you know, Journal of the Adventist Theological Society's history. We've highlighted both of them, although without ever talking about this connection that I'm talking about right now. To conclude, or get near the end of this second section, overall, it is important to note that according to the latest data, religious voters in America are split almost 50-50, Republican and Democrat, religious voters altogether. As some pollsters recently noted, the latest data, quote, puts to rest the question of whether there is a God gap between Republicans and Democrats. Clearly, from this data, it's not only closing, it's closed, end quote. Thus, the God gap that many pundits made headlines with, and which does still exist, I want to emphasize it still does exist. There are, you know, secular right people as well. But the headline days of the 1980s and 90s of the religious right have peaked. It has now passed over the hill and is into a somewhat of a valley. Whether it will rise again or not is obviously room for discussion there. However, unless there are unexpected demographic changes waiting for America, I will say that the religious right may be replaced by the religious left during the next 25 years as the dominant sociopolitical influence without even superior drive and organization. The data is inconclusive. And as an Adventist, I'm not sure what difference it makes, I think is the point I'm obviously trying to share with you. Okay, part three. Interesting fact number three. Seventh-day Adventists and Roman Catholics closely share an important corporate identity marker that is quite unusual in the religious world for large, united religious groups, which, as Adventism emerges into a major world religious identity, finally, we're now the eighth largest, I guess, according to some numbers I've seen, eighth largest international religious identity, is noteworthy. Adventists and Catholics are equally divided on their secular, socio-political worldview identifications. We're together. We think we have the same divisions in our worldviews. Very interesting. Although no precise numbers obviously exist for American Catholics or American Adventists and their sociopolitical leanings, as one sample survey that was done at Andrews and other colleges indicated, alongside my own personal observations over 15 years, Adventists vote roughly in line with the general population, including following the population's widespread stereotypes. In other words, if you weren't an Adventist, how you would vote depends simply on your background. If you match the profile of a Republican or a Democrat in any other way, respectively, chances are that's how you'll vote as an Adventist. To be clear, being or becoming an Adventist apparently makes no difference in how you see the socio-political world. Adventist theology, thus far, has not created a unified American Adventist socio-cultural political worldview. Rather, it has left us ever more fragmented in an ever more polarized secular political climate. Can you sense the need for warning about a crisis? A very curious phenomena. The above fact is, I believe, one of the more complex factors in the present polarization and fragmentation of American Adventism, and in a distant way, no doubt, global Adventism. Theologically, I think there's a theological, you know, links with how we have a worldviews. It also raises the question of how carefully Adventists actually think about the relationship between theology, philosophy, and society. Are we thinkers or mere reflectors of other men's ideas? Thus far, it appears we are reflectors, not thinkers. However, we are not alone in our fragmentation, as I just mentioned. The above also holds true for self-identifying American Catholics, who have also, interestingly, always supported the winner of the past several U.S. presidential elections since the culture wars began. You'll see the only time they lost was in 2000 when they supported Al Gore instead of George W. Bush. So they actually supported the majority winner, even though the Electoral College did not grant Bush the winner. So the Catholics have always picked, always slid with the majority. From Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush to Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, the Catholics always supported him. The Catholics know and make a winner. As George Neumeyer explains, even Barack Obama rose to power not in spite of the Catholic Church, but in part because of it. And he explains some arguments and reasons why he thinks that is so. Importantly, on this note, it is worthwhile to mention that although American Catholic leaders have had and still do have a conservative stereotype by most American Adventists who have talked about them, and it is true, over the past, three decades, because of two hot-button issues, the gay marriage and abortion, it is important to note that Pope Francis has been hailed as above such culture wars, a pope that can bring Catholics together from more left-leaning and right-leaning Catholic perspectives. Pope Francis has followed through on this initiative. By the way, he's the exact opposite of his predecessor, Pope Benedict, who was the extreme religious rights friend. Now we have the religious left's two living popes. There's something going on here. Pope Francis has followed through with this initiative, interestingly becoming the first modern pope to explicitly downplay the political importance of gay marriage and abortion, if you've been following his comments in the news, even while he still maintains theological orthodoxy, and I could not neglect to mention that point. However, it must also be noted that for the first time in modern history, a few religious right Catholics, conservatives from Patrick Buchanan's religious right days, are actually unhappy with their new pope, Francis, with some openly disappointed and even critical of the Pope's leftist, socialist, and Marxist sentiments. Those are quotes taken from critics, which has been picked up by even secular right-wing commentators like Rush Limbaugh, who has called Francis a Marxist. Of course, Francis didn't quite agree, but he had good friends that were Marxists, he said. Just a couple more words on Pope Francis. Some have seen him, and this is actually again from articles, as the single greatest threat to emerge that could challenge the existence of the religious right. When Francis removed one of the more outspoken critics of abortion and gay marriage in America, Raymond Burke, from the Congregation of Bishops, it signaled a change of approach towards those who are less heavily invested in the culture wars. As such, it seems that the more popular sentiments that are winning the day point toward Pope Francis as the great unifier, able to bring together the left and right, here meaning Catholic and non-Catholic, Republicans and Democrats, and he has done so, winning an overwhelming majority of Americans. 92% gave him favorable ratings of Catholics, and 69% of non-Catholics approve of the Pope. And he became Time Magazine's Person of the Year in 2013, and also received a cover issue from Rolling Stone, a very liberal magazine, because they thought he was such a great guy. Fascinating. Who can do this? Who can do this but Pope Francis? It seems Catholicism has recovered from its scandals with its priests and sexual abuse of the last few decades. This is further evidenced by his recent invitation, I will note, to speak before Congress. Probably some of you are aware of this, both Republican and Catholic majority and minority leaders, John Boehner and Nancy Pelosi, also Catholic, invited him to speak. I don't think he has accepted yet, but who knows whether he will, whether he'll feel the time is right, but who knows. It has brought together our parties in a way that no one else could ever do. I would love to discuss more why I think that's the case, but that will have to wait. I do want to note, by the way, that there is only one group that has consistently given kind of skeptical or critical remarks of Pope Francis, and it is actually the Tea Party. I know that that is itself a politically sensitive group. However, I will also note that on the far left of Adventist circles, ATS has been called the Tea Party of Adventism. So whether or not, whether that's good or bad, whether you like that or disagree with that, I actually, I don't really agree with it, although I don't mind it if that's what they, if it means that I'm anti-Catholic, so be it. As it pertains to Adventism, however, there are many consequences of the socio-political worldview identity spider trap. Perhaps none more important than the extreme confusion that our younger generation is experiencing in understanding what it means to think and see both the world and the church within it as an Adventist, particularly living in America. What is the Adventist worldview in a holistic sense? It is a mistake, apparently, to assume that the Great Controversy provides a complete or holistic worldview, in the sense of the way I'm thinking of the concept here. A worldview contains more than simply a theological and theoretical framework, like the Great Controversy motif, or Platonic metaphysics, which explains a lot of other things about the nature of reality. A worldview addresses principles that sociopolitical ideologies also address. Matters of economic theory and social justice, religious liberty. Plato is cited by, economic theorists. Really, he is. Religious liberty, foreign policy, as I mentioned, and I'm into philosophy, that's really my area. The nature of mathematics, what are numbers and all these kinds of discussions, that's philosophy. Plato did all that stuff, so there's a worldview there. The Great Controversy doesn't talk about those kinds of issues, and so Adventists have not had a philosophical underpinnings for what they believe. They only have theological ones. I have to mention that our colleges offer degrees in all of these areas, and I think that obviously, I'll be blunt, if the Great Controversy were understood as a holistic worldview, it would provide socio-political guidance. I didn't say a choice. I did not say that. I said it would provide guidance. Maybe it does, but I find that more and more younger and older Adventists have either no definite answer to the above questions, or that their answers directly, as is obviously evident, conflict with each other. We are caught within the socio-political spider web. The above leads me to conclude this section with a few open questions that I hope all of my listeners will ponder. Why is it that Adventists and Catholics are truly unique in their socio-political acquiescence to live within the prevalent tensions in the major American socio-political identities? If nothing else, it is interesting precisely because it is not the trend that has been recently occurring in several other sizable socio-religious groups in America. Although, again, if Catholicism can keep bringing people together, who knows what will happen. This point cannot be emphasized enough. If I may also leave one provocative question, the Catholics have a pope to ensure unity, despite their American socio-political confusion. The pope has, always, the hierarchy of the church has always kind of left itself out of that. However, we do not have a pope. Can we survive the political polarization that no other Protestant group has managed to survive and maintain dual or socio-political sympathies, which run rampant throughout, by the way, our colleges? Maybe we have a chance to succeed because we have a higher pope, we have the true head of the church, and the other Protestant churches don't. So maybe there is room for optimism. But I have to ask that question. People point to our theological divisions on issues like ordination. I would, however, propose that at the level of our socio-political worldview groundwork, we are also divided, and this one is in many ways more significant because it penetrates into how we really do think, strategize about our evangelism, develop philosophical principles for undergirding how we run our educational and organizational structures, how we really work with humans. In all levels of organization. It is serious to have philosophical differences that are this polarized. Conclusion. Does it matter? Yes, I think it does. Earlier this year, I attended a moderate-sized, non-Adventist Christian conference in San Diego, California, called Truth Exchange. It was composed primarily of Presbyterians. Presbyterian Church hosted the event, but its attendees included a variety of other Christian scholars and laypersons from diverse theological backgrounds, actually, a little ecumenical subgroup here. Anglicans, Baptists, non-denominationals, they were all there, all of whom would be labeled in this example as part of the conservative religious right, although they did not seem very warm about that identification, but they acknowledged they would be called as such by the secular media. My experience there, observing their self-created identity, gave me a momentary pause for thought on how the Adventist identity is perceived today by both Adventists and by outsiders. I note that this is an issue I've been reflecting on for several years as I have traveled and studied at Andrews University, which is one of the most diverse colleges, literally, in the United States. Christian and non-Christian Adventists are not. We're one of the most diverse colleges, so I have had the opportunity to meet people from every perspective. That's a great thing about being at Andrews. Several things stood out to me at the Truth Exchange Conference. There are mostly subtle and a few not so subtle doctrinal differences. Didn't seem to matter very much in relation to the unity of their broader sociocultural philosophical worldview. Their patriarch, Peter Jones, had succinctly boiled it down into oneism and twoism. Oneism is where you worship the creation, and twoism is where you worship God and distinguish between the two. Very simple, very effective. He would be what you would call non-denominational / Presbyterian conservative, very Bible serious, devout Christian. He found effective in his evangelism to create kind of a little sub-movement was to boil it down and simplify it into a philosophical worldview that could draw unity. So I saw that it worked. It worked for them. They were all thinking alike, or not quite alike, but I mean they all had this broad sympathy. You know, something that you can argue about or discuss that whether that's good or bad. But it appeared good. I was impressed by their spirituality and their sincerity. They were really Bible-believing people. They really were trying to do the right thing. Part of the reason that I was particularly interested in this group, which is just one example group, was that the host and his wife made comments that their views represented what they were sure would be a small remnant within the forces of secular scientism and apostate Christianity, which for them did include primarily Catholicism and the emerging church. So, of course, I have to bleed some sympathy with this group. While also openly and explicitly expressing an open-minded uncertainty on the meaning of Revelation and the image to the beast. When I heard the wife of the Peter Jones say, "I'm not sure what the image to the beast is. That's the only thing I'm not sure about, but everything else is clear to me." So I was really impressed. My point of sharing this is that, put simply, these people would be attracted to a Christian movement that leans to one side of the sociopolitical aisle. Adventist dualism would appear schizophrenic and unappealing to this group of people. They have realized the power of a sociopolitical, philosophical perspective, and that your theology and philosophy should match. I want to quickly add, having shared that example, that I'm aware of other groups which would have the exact opposite reaction, that the way that they think would give them the exact opposite impressions, and they would be appealing to an opposite sociopolitical perspective. I'm aware of both. I just noting this one just for the purposes of an example. I am concluding here in 1 minute. The world wants to know, insofar as it is aware of us, now far more than even in White's time, I believe, what we believe about the direction the world should go on major sociopolitical issues. An open invitation awaits us to walk on to the web and become yet another conservative or liberal denomination and ally our identity accordingly. My suggestion today to you is that we must resist that invitation while simultaneously understanding why it is offered to us. What precisely our corporate identity will become in the eyes of the world beyond our distinctives as we continue to fulfill a sanctuary gospel great controversy system is only located in a yet unrealized and unknown future. However, when we move forward, conscious as we are of our remnant status through a sanctuary gospel lens, whatever the result, we must remain conscious of what precisely we are avoiding. We need to have the era end, that is the era of obliviousness concerning how we are presenting a divided corporate sociopolitical witness to the world. We need to, as a church, acknowledge this and individually and deal with it so that we are not an evangelistic barrier to other people who might want to join our church. Yes, we must remain aware of the issues that the world is expecting of any Christian system, but this does not mean we must incorporate any elements from the world. It is merely imperative that we develop this consciousness of what things the world world is expecting from a Christian system, so we can formulate our real Adventist system with such an awareness built in to better respond to the outside concerns as they arise and evolve, and point them towards the inner logic that sustains the Seventh-day Adventist theological system, and that we do have the most broad interests that the world is facing, that we do address them, and that the identities that we can create as Seventh-day Adventist Christians are the ones that do matter to the 21st century world. Thank you.